Porridge on Islak. It must be admitted that the method invented by Sita Dilip is not always entirely reliable. You sometimes find yourself on a plane that wasn't the one you meant to go to. If whenever you travel you carry with you a copy of Rornan's handy planary guide, you can read up on wherever it is you get to when you get there, though Rornan is not always reliable either. But the Encyclopedia Planaria, in 44 volumes, is not portable, and after all, what is entirely reliable, unless it's dead? I arrived on Islak unintentionally, when I was inexperienced, before I had learned to tuck Rornan into my suitcase. The interplanary hotel there did have a set of the encyclopedia, but it was at the bindery because, they said, the bears had eaten the glue in the bindings and the books had all come to pieces. I thought they must have rather odd bears on Islak, but did not like to ask about them. I looked around the halls and my room carefully in case any bears were lurking. It was a beautiful hotel, and the hosts were pleasant, so I had already decided to take my luck as it came and spend a day or two on Islak. I got to looking over the books in the bookcase in my room and trying out the built-in legimat, and had quite forgotten about bears, when something scuttled behind a bookend. I moved the bookend and glimpsed the scuttler. It was dark and furry, but had a long, thin tail of some kind, almost like wire. It was 6 or 8 inches long, not counting the tail. I didn't much like sharing my room with it, but I hate complaining to strangers. You can only complain satisfactorily to people you know really well. So I moved the heavy bookend over the hole in the wall the creature had disappeared into and went down to dinner. The hotel served family style, all the guests at one long table. They were a friendly lot from several different planes. We were able to converse in pairs using our translato mats, though general conversation overloaded the circuits. My left-hand neighbor, a rosy lady from a plane she called Ah Yes, said she and her husband came to Islak quite often. I asked her if she knew anything about the bears here. "Yes," she said, smiling and nodding. "They're quite harmless. But what little pests they are, spoiling books and licking envelopes and snuggling in the bed."
"Snuggling in the bed?"
"Yes, yes. They were pets, you see." Her husband leaned forward to talk to me around her. He was a rosy gentleman.
"Teddy bears," he said in English, smiling. "Yes."
"Teddy bears?"
"Yes, yes," he said, and then had to resort to his own language. "Teddy bears are little animal pets for children, isn't that right?"
"But they're not live animals." He looked dismayed.
"Dead animals?"
"No, stuffed animals, toys."
"Yes, yes, toys, pets," he said, smiling and nodding.
He wanted to talk about his visit to my plane. He had been to San Francisco and liked it very much, and we talked about earthquakes instead of teddy bears. He had found a 5.6 earthquake a very charming experience, very enjoyable, and he and his wife and I laughed a great deal as he told about it. They were certainly a nice couple, with a positive outlook. When I went back to my room, I shoved my suitcase up against the bookend that blocked the hole in the wall and lay in bed hoping that the teddy bears did not have a back door. Nothing snuggled into the bed with me that night. I woke very early, being jet-lagged by flying from London to Chicago, where my westbound flight had been delayed, allowing me this vacation. It was a lovely, warm morning, the sun just rising. I got up and went out to take the air and see the city of Sloss on the Islak Plain. It might have been a big city on my plane, nothing exotic to my eye, except the buildings were more mixed in style and in size than ours. That is, we put the big, imposing buildings at the center and on the nice streets,
and the small humble ones in the neighborhoods or barrios or slums or shanty towns. In this residential quarter of Slas, big houses were all jumbled up together with tiny cottages, some of them hardly bigger than hutches. When I went the other direction, downtown, I found the same wild variations of scale in the office buildings. A massive old four-story granite block towered over a 10-story building 10 feet wide, with floors only 5 or 6 feet apart. A doll's skyscraper. By then, however, enough Islai were out and about that the buildings didn't puzzle me as much as the people did. They were amazingly various in size, in color, in shape. A woman who must have been 8 feet tall swept past me, literally. She was a street sweeper, busily and gracefully clearing the sidewalk of dust. She had what I took to be a spare broom or duster, a great spray of feathers, tucked into her waistband and back like an ostrich's tail. Next came a businessman striding along, hooked up to the computer network via a plug in his ear, a mouthpiece, and the left frame of his spectacles, talking away as he studied the market report. He came up about to my waist. 4 young men passed on the other side of the street. There was nothing odd about them, except that they all looked exactly alike. Then came a schoolchild, trotting to school with his little backpack. He trotted on all fours, neatly, his hands in leather mitts or boots that protected them from the pavement. He was pale, with small eyes and a snout, but he was adorable. A sidewalk cafe had just opened up beside a park downtown. Though ignorant of what the Islai ate for breakfast, I was ravenous, ready to dare anything edible. I held out my translator mat to the waitress, a worn-looking woman of 40 or so, with nothing unusual about her, to my eye, but the beauty of her thick, yellow, fancifully braided hair. "Please tell me what a foreigner eats for breakfast," I said. She laughed, then smiled a beautiful, kind smile, and said, via the translator mat, "Well, you have to tell me that. We eat kledif, or fruit with kledif." "Fruit with kledif, please," I said. And presently she brought me a plate of delicious-looking fruits and a large bowl of pale yellow gruel, smooth, about as thick as very heavy cream, lukewarm. It sounds ghastly, but it was delicious, mild but subtle, lightly filling and slightly stimulating, like café au lait. She waited to see if I liked it. "I'm sorry, I didn't think to ask you if you were a carnivore," she said. "Carnivores have raw cullis for breakfast, or kledif with offal." "This is fine," I said. Nobody else was in the place, and she had taken a shine to me, as I had to her. "May I ask where you come from?" she asked, and so we got to talking. Her name was Ailiale. I soon realized she was not only an intelligent person, but a highly educated one. She had a degree in plant pathology, but was lucky, she said, to have a job as a waitress. "Since the ban," she said, shrugging. And when she saw that I didn't know what the ban was, she was about to tell me. But several customers were sitting down now, a great bull of a man at one table, 2 mousy girls at another, and she had to go wait on them. "I wish we could go on talking," I said. And she said, with her kind smile, "Well, if you come back at 16, I can sit and talk with you." "I will," I said, and I did. After wandering around the park and the city, I went back to the hotel for lunch and a nap, then took the monorail back downtown. I never saw such a variety of people as were in that car. All shapes, sizes, colors, degrees of hairiness, furriness, featheriness. The street sweeper's tail had indeed been a tail. And I thought, looking at one long greenish youth, even leafiness. Surely those were fronds over his ears. He was whispering to himself as the warm wind swept through the car from the open windows. The only thing the Islai seemed to have in common, unfortunately, was poverty. The city certainly had been prosperous once, not very long ago. The monorail was a snazzy bit of engineering, but it was showing wear and tear. The surviving old buildings, which were on a scale I found familiar, were grand but run down, and crowded by the more recent giants' houses and dolls' houses and buildings like stables or mews or rabbit hutches. A terrible hodgepodge, all of it cheaply built, rickety-looking, shabby. And the Islai themselves were shabby, when they weren't downright ragged. Some of the furrier and featherier ones were clothed only by their fur and feathers. The green boy wore a modesty apron, but his rough trunk and limbs were bare. This was a country in deep, hard economic trouble. Ailiale was sitting at one of the outside tables at the cafe, the Kledefak, next door to the one where she waited tables. She smiled and beckoned to me, and I sat down with her. She had a small bowl of chilled kledef with sweet spices, and I ordered the same. "Please tell me about the ban," I asked her. "We used to look like you," she said. "What happened?" "Well," she said and hesitated, "we like science. We like engineering. We are good engineers, but perhaps we are not very good scientists." To summarize her story, the Islai had been strong on practical physics, agriculture, architecture, urban development, practical invention, but weak in the life sciences, history, and theory. They had their Edisons and Fords, but no Darwin, no Mendel. When their airports got to be just like ours, if not worse, they began to travel between planes. And on some plane, about 100 years ago, one of their scientists discovered applied genetics. He brought it home. It fascinated them. They promptly mastered its principles. Or perhaps they had not quite mastered them before they started applying them to every life form within reach. First, she said, to plants, altering food plants to be more fruitful, or to resist bacteria and viruses, or to kill insects, and so on. I nodded. "We're doing a good deal of that, too," I said. "Really? Are you..." She seemed not to know how to ask the question she wanted to ask. "I'm corn myself," she said at last, shyly. I checked the translator mat. "Uzlu. Corn? Maize." I checked the dictionary, and it said that uzlu on Islak and maize on my plane are the same plant. I knew that the odd thing about corn is that it has no wild form, only a distant wild ancestor that you'd never recognize as corn. It's entirely a construct of long-term breeding by ancient gatherers and farmers, an early genetic miracle. But what did it have to do with Ailiale? Ailiale, with her wonderful, thick, gold-colored, corn-colored hair cascading in braids from a topknot. "Only 4% of my genome," she said. "There's about 0.5% of parrot, too, but it's recessive, thank God." I was still trying to absorb what she had told me. I think she felt her question had been answered by my astonished silence. "They were utterly irresponsible," she said severely. "With all their programs and policies and making everything better, they were fools. They let all kinds of things get loose and interbreed. Wiped out rice in one decade. The improved breeds went sterile. The famines were terrible. Butterflies. We used to have butterflies. Do you have them?" "Some, still," I said. "And Delatu, a kind of singing firefly, now extinct," said my translator mat. I shook my head wistfully. She shook her head wistfully. "I never saw a butterfly or a Delatu, only pictures. The insecticidal clones got them. But the scientists learned nothing. Nothing. They set about improving the animals, improving us. Dogs that could talk, cats that could play chess, human beings who were going to be all geniuses and never get sick and live 500 years. They did all that. Oh, yes, they did all that. There are talking dogs all over the place. Unbelievably boring they are. On and on and on about sex and shit and smells. And smells and shit and sex and do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? I can't stand talking dogs. My big poodle, Rover, he never says a word, the dear good soul. And then the humans. We'll never get rid of the premier. He's a healthy, a bloody GAPA. He's 90 now and looks 30, and he'll go on looking 30 and being premier for 4 more centuries. He's a pious hypocrite and a greedy, petty, stupid, mean-minded crook. Just the kind of man who ought to be siring children for 5 centuries. The ban doesn't apply to him. But still, I'm not saying the ban was wrong. They had to do something. Things were really awful 50 years ago. When they realized that genetic hackers had infiltrated all the laboratories, and half the techs were bioist fanatics, and the God's Own Church had all those secret factories in the Eastern Hemisphere deliberately turning out genetic melds. Of course, most of those products weren't viable, but a lot of them were. The hackers were so good at it. The chicken people. You've seen them? As soon as she asked, I realized that I had. Short, squat people who ran around in intersections squawking so that all the traffic gridlocked in an effort not to run them over. They just make me want to cry, Ailele said, looking as if she wanted to cry. So the ban forbade further experimentation? I asked. She nodded. Yes. Actually, they blew up the laboratories and sent the bioists for re-education in the Gooby and jailed all the God's Own fathers and most of the mothers, too, I guess, and shot the geneticists and destroyed all the experiments in progress and the products if they were, she shrugged, too far from the norm. The norm. She scowled, though her sunny face was not made for scowling. We don't have a norm anymore. We don't have species anymore. We're a genetic porridge. When we plant maize, it comes up weevil-repellent clover that smells like chlorine. When we plant an oak, it comes up poison oak 50 feet high with a 10-foot thick trunk. And when we make love, we don't know if we're going to have a baby or a foal or a cygnet or a sapling. My daughter, and she paused. Her face worked, and she had to compress her lips before she could go on. My daughter lives in the North Sea, on raw fish. She's very beautiful, dark and silky and beautiful. But I had to take her to the seacoast when she was 2 years old. I had to put her in that cold water, those big waves. I had to let her swim away, let her go be what she is. But she is human, too. She is human, too. She was crying, and so was I. After a while, Ailele went on to tell me how the genome collapse had led to profound economic depression, only worsened by the purity clauses of the ban, which restricted jobs in the professions and government to those who tested 99.44% human, with exceptions for healthies, righteous ones, and other GAPAs, genetically altered products approved by the emergency government. This was why she was working as a waitress. She was 4% maize. Maize was once a holy plant of many people where I come from, I said, hardly knowing what I said. It is such a beautiful plant. I love everything made out of corn, polenta, hoe cake, cornbread, tortillas, canned corn, creamed corn, hominy, grits, corn whiskey, corn chowder, on the cob, tamales. It's all good. All good, all kind, all sacred. I hope you don't mind if I talk about eating it. Heavens no, said Ailele, smiling. What do you think Kledif was made from? After a while, I asked her about teddy bears. That phrase, of course, meant nothing to her, but when I described the creature in my bookcase, she nodded. Oh, yes, book bears. Early on, when the genetic designers were making everything better, you know, they dwarfed bears way down for children's pets, like toys, stuffed animals, only they were alive, programmed to be passive and affectionate. But some of the genes they used for dwarfing came from insects, springtails and earwigs. And the bears began to eat the children's books. At night, while they were supposed to be cuddling in bed with the children, they'd go eat their books. They liked paper and glue. And when they bred, the offspring had long tails, like wires, and a sort of insect jaw, so they weren't much good for the children anymore. But by then they'd escaped into the woodwork, between the walls. Some people call them bear wigs. I have been back to Islak several times to see Ailele. It is not a happy plane, or a reassuring one, but I would go to worse places than Islak to see so kind a smile, such a top knot of gold, and to drink maize with the woman who is maize.